When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.
The FT.
Welcome to the World Weekly podcast from the Financial Times. I'm Gideon Rachman, the FT's Chief Foreign Affairs Commentator, and I'll be presenting this podcast, aided by Helen Worrell, who's here in the studio with me. Hi, Helen.
Hello.
Each week we're focusing on some of the major international political stories that are making the headlines, and we'll be drawing upon the FT's team of foreign correspondents and international analysts to make sense of world events. This week we're starting with BP, which is now not just an environmental disaster, but also a political and diplomatic catastrophe. Ed Crooks, our energy editor, is in the studio to assess the damage, both environmentally and politically. We'll also hear later from our correspondent in Jerusalem, Tobias Buck, on how Israel may be changing its stance on Gaza and the blockade.
There's been something of a cumulative effect here. Israel has been through several instances over the past few months, and I think there's just a sense that something had to give.
But first, BP. The Deepwater Horizon explosion on April the 20th has caused one of the world's biggest ever oil spills, untold environmental damage, and now threatens the future of BP, one of the world's largest energy companies. It's also seen a media storm, with BP chief executive Tony Hayward vilified in the press and by American politicians. On Wednesday, President Obama met BP's chief executive and chairman, and it appeared that the mood was a little bit better after that meeting. So, Ed, do you think BP are now through the worst, at least, of the political storm?
I think they may be, yes. I think certainly in many ways the problem is very, very far from over. There's still going to be a big investigation or series of investigations into the disaster and exactly what happened. That could turn out very badly for BP in terms of the company's actions leading up to the accident. The oil is still leaking out of the well, of course, and they still have to deal with that, and their efforts to contain it so far have not been very successful. The oil is still washing up on the beaches right the way around the Gulf. People are still very angry and concerned about that. A lot of industries are still badly affected in terms of bans on fishing and in terms of the effect on tourism and so on. But politically, there does seem to be a new mood there. There does seem to be a new climate. As you say, the meeting appears to have gone pretty well by BP agreeing to pay this $20 billion into a fund to help compensate the victims of the disaster. It does now look as though essentially they've kind of bought themselves some time and space with the administration, and the administration has been coming out and saying that they are essentially giving assurances they're not trying to destroy BP. They talk about that we see a virtue, and the President, Barack Obama, talked about this. He said we see a virtue in BP being a strong and viable company. We want it to remain that way. And that's obviously a very important statement for BP.
And BP shares rose afterwards. But, I mean, the President may not be actually attempting to destroy BP, but is he perhaps willing, do you think, still to see it as collateral damage? Do you think he ultimately cares in the end, or is his real concern just to A, douse the political fire, and B, make sure that BP picks up the bills?
I think that's right, as you say. I think actually it would be quite damaging for the United States if BP was completely destroyed as a result of this. I think it would send a bad signal about foreign investment coming into the US. Of course, BP's shareholders, 40% of them are in the US as well, so it would be a very unpopular move with all of them. BP employs more than 20,000 people in America as well who might lose their jobs if the company failed and so on. So for all those reasons, I think it's right to think that the administration does want to preserve BP as a going concern. But as you said, Barack Obama's facing very, very severe political pressure. I guess the other thing that's probably happened as a result of this fund now being set up is he's eased that pressure on himself a bit. That actually, if you hear a lot of the reaction afterwards, it's been pretty positive. In fact, even some Republicans have been saying, at last we're seeing the president doing something useful, doing something constructive, you know, in this whole saga. Now, what is it, 8 weeks it's been going on. The administration has been greatly criticised for its slow and inadequate response. Now they have apparently done something pretty concrete to the tune of $20 billion worth, and that does seem to be, as I say, winning President Obama some support, therefore easing the pressure on him, so he will not need to go quite so hard on BP.
How, finally, do you think this has changed the debate on energy security in the US? Because President Obama's been a bit all over the place, and, you know, initially he was very much into green energy, then he lifted the ban on offshore drilling a month before this terrible disaster, and then in his White House address he seemed to be back on the sort of we've got to wean ourselves off oil line. Do you think things will actually happen, or is this just a rhetorical shift?
I think it's just a rhetorical shift. I'm afraid to be pessimistic about this, but I think there are very often these kind of events come up and everyone says everything will change after this. This is a game changer. And then nothing very much does change. I think that if you look at the way the US economy is constructed and the way the energy system of the United States works, it's very, very hard to shift in a really significant way away from the main sources of their energy, which are coal and oil. And it's going to be, I think, beyond... It was certainly beyond the president's powers before this incident to try and shift that, and it became very clear that it was going to be very hard to get energy and climate legislation through Congress. I don't really think that this disaster, as huge as it was, I don't think even then it's going to make a difference to the way Americans perceive fossil fuels and the fact that they're going to want to still carry on relying on fossil fuels. I think people will say, yes, this was a terrible accident. It should never be allowed to happen again. We must have stricter controls on drilling. We must make sure that we don't have these kind of huge spills in future. But are they going to say, yes, let's move away from oil, let's give up on this and move to biofuels or electric cars much faster than we have been? I don't think so.
Ed, thanks very much indeed. Now over to Helen for some of the other major world news stories of the week.
Thanks, Gideon. Israel has been at the centre of international disapproval after last month's attack on a Turkish flotilla carrying aid to Gaza. The country is now looking at ways to soften its position on the Gaza blockade. Tobias Buck, our Jerusalem correspondent, spoke earlier to one of our world news editors, Fiona Simon.
In the wake of the attack on the aid flotilla en route to Gaza, Israel's faced some quite unprecedented criticism. But it's faced down criticism before, so why now do you think it might be changing its mind about the blockade?
It is certainly true that Israel has in the past been very happy to ignore criticism coming from abroad, in particular when it comes to its policy in Gaza, where we've seen a very tight economic blockade in place for more than 3 years. I think the reason why Israel is about to change its mind and at the very least relax the siege on the Gaza Strip is the fact that the US has sort of joined the chorus of critics, and I think also there's been something of a cumulative effect here. Israel has been through several instances over the past few months where actions taken by senior Israeli politicians have sort of created an outcry. We've had, of course, the assassination of a Hamas agent in Dubai, and I think there's just a sense that that something had to give after all of these incidents, and in particular after the very bloody and very controversial one in the Eastern Mediterranean, where, after all, 9 pro-Palestinian activists from a nominal ally of Israel, namely Turkey, were killed.
Do you think there's also a sense that perhaps the blockade hasn't achieved what it set out to achieve?
Well, I think many in the Israeli security establishment would probably privately agree with that. They would say that there's no evidence that Hamas has been weakened as a result of this embargo. On the contrary, by creating this smuggling network, thanks to which tons and tons of products arrive in through smuggling tunnels from Egypt, and creating a market which is under the complete control of Hamas. The embargo has actually allowed Hamas to consolidate its regime in Gaza. According to most, I would say, neutral observers, the embargo has not worked. But at the same time, it's very difficult for Israel to change course for domestic political reasons.
So what do you think is their thinking? I mean, what form is this easing of the embargo likely to take?
Well, we've basically had a very intense discussion over the last almost 2 weeks among the senior Israeli leaders as to what exactly they should do. I think there is a consensus that that something must be done, and that basically two principles are guiding the Israeli leadership in their in their thinking. The first is that civilian goods, or what they call civilian goods, which tend to be sort of consumer staples, food, drinks, these kind of things, they should be allowed to enter Gaza in greater quantities, and also a wider range of products should be able to get into Gaza. At the same time, of course, the Israeli government will insist that no security-sensitive materials can enter the Gaza Strip. I think the really interesting question is what will happen, for example, with regard to construction materials. Of course, we had the war in Gaza last year. Thousands of houses were destroyed, and Gazans have been unable to rebuild them. Now, Israel has so far always insisted that construction materials can't go into Gaza, quite simply because they say Hamas would use them to construct bunkers and other sort of military infrastructure. Now, if Israel relaxes the import regime for Gaza for construction materials, they will want to make sure that whatever cement and bricks and steel and glass they let in does not find its way into the Hamas military wing. So quite possibly we could see the UN taking a very prominent role in actually administering the distribution of these materials in the Gaza Strip.
So for the Palestinians themselves, how important is this move to ease the blockade going to be in practice? How much difference is it going to make to their day-to-day lives, do you think?
Well, the suspicion must be that the impact on the lives of ordinary Palestinians in the Gaza Strip won't actually be that great. Let's not forget that, after all, most consumer products do somehow find their way into Gaza through the tunnels. Of course, they are too expensive for the vast majority of Gazans. What would make a major difference to Gazans, I think, is actually not so much what goes into Gaza, but what can go out of Gaza. The Gaza economy has in the past been heavily dependent on exports of fruit and vegetables, exports of clothes, furniture, all kinds of sort of simple manufactured products. That was a real strength of the Gaza private sector. Now, the private sector has essentially been obliterated. There's nothing left of it in the Gaza Strip. So in order for the economy to get growing, in order for jobs to be created, in order to sort of wean Gaza society off international aid, what really needs to happen is an opening of the Gaza borders to exports. And on that, we have not heard very much from the Israeli government.
That was Tobias Buck in Jerusalem talking to Fiona Simon on Wednesday. So, Gideon, would Israel have changed its policy on the blockade without this furore over the aid flotilla?
Well, it certainly heightened the pressure on them to do it. So, you know, at some point they would have changed it, but it's clearly they've felt a growing international pressure. And I think that the Israelis have two major diplomatic worries at the moment. They, as Tobias said, they're used to not being incredibly popular in their region or indeed in large parts of the world. But there are two relationships that are going wrong in some way. I mean, the most dramatic change has been the relationship with Turkey. Turkey used to be the only big Muslim country with which Israel had a decent relationship. It's a very important neighbour as well. You know, it's close by. The relations were so close. The Israeli army, I think it may even still, Air Force may still train there. But, you know, of late, the relationship with Turkey has soured in a very dramatic way, so that the government of Prime Minister Erdogan is now more overtly hostile to Israel in some ways than traditional enemies such as the Egyptians or the Arab world. And I was told, for example, that posters of Erdogan are now all over the Gaza Strip because he's seen as a sort of popular hero. And that's a very dangerous development for the Israelis, and one they're profoundly uncomfortable with. The second development that will be alarming them, and is again fairly, you know, much discussed, is the deterioration in their relationship with the US since the beginning of the Obama administration. Now, that's less serious in one sense, of course. You know, they're still close allies with America. But any change in that relationship, any cooling, is dangerous for them because the US is the sole superpower. It's also Israel's closest friend in the world. So if it appears that things are going worse for them in America and in Washington, that is dangerous for them.
Thanks very much, Gideon. Much of Osh, the capital of South Kyrgyzstan, now lies in ruins after days of ethnic fighting that has left at least 189 people dead and forced as many as 100,000 ethnic Uzbeks to flee for safety in neighbouring Uzbekistan. The violence is the worst to hit the area since an uprising in April that toppled Kerkmenbek Bakiyev, the country's president. Neil Buckley, our Eastern Europe editor, joins us in the studio. Neil, let's go back a little. What do we know about the conflict so far and how it started?
Well, as you mentioned, there was a violent overthrow of the former president of Kyrgyzstan, Kerkmenbek Bakiyev, back in April. Mr. Bakiyev, of course, had come to power in 2005 and really dressed himself in the mantle of democracy after a couple of other so-called color revolutions or pro-democracy revolutions in other former Soviet states. But he unfortunately started to show authoritarian tendencies quite quickly, never really delivered economic improvement within Kyrgyzstan, and people have become disillusioned with him. The problem is the government that the interim government that took over after he was deposed has not established control over the south of the country. The south is really the stronghold of support for Mr. Bakiyev. That support is among the Kyrgyz population in the south of the country, but there is also a sizable Uzbek minority. Uzbekistan is the neighbouring state to that region. The Uzbeks have supported the new provisional government because they felt that they were discriminated against by the previous one and have been hoping for a better deal from this one. And we've seen very, very significant, very unpleasant violence between the Kyrgyz and Uzbek populations. 189 people killed is the official figure, but there are many reports that that the real figure may be much higher. And although the violence has died down in the last day or two, there is a huge refugee problem, an approaching humanitarian crisis because of the number of people who have been displaced from their homes and are crossing the border into neighbouring Uzbekistan.
Now, the interim government that you mentioned has actually blamed Mr. Bakiyev's supporters for this conflict, although he has fiercely denied any involvement in it. Who do you think is likely to be behind the uprising?
It's very difficult to tell at this point. It isn't, in fact, just the Kyrgyz provisional government. Some external observers on the ground, NGOs and so on, have pointed the finger at supporters of Mr. Bakiyev or even at members of Mr. Bakiyev's family for having incited the violence. But it's difficult to at the moment to see how much evidence there is for that. There were reports that Mr. Bakiyev's son, Maxim, had been detained by British immigration authorities, but the authorities in the UK have been a bit circumspect in what they've said about this. Certainly there are strong suspicions that this violence was incited in some way or may have been encouraged in some way and was not entirely spontaneous.
We know that the Kyrgyz government has repeatedly asked for military assistance from the Russians to help control this conflict. The Russians announced on Thursday that they could send in advisers, but crucially not peacekeepers, to help the authorities. What do you think these advisers will actually do in practice?
I think sending in advisers achieves two goals for the Russians. One is that it will enable them to keep an eye on what's happening on the ground. Clearly, there is a great deal of concern in Moscow over events here because this is a region that is something of a tinderbox. There is a patchwork of different nationalities. It's also a drugs trade route from Afghanistan. So Moscow is concerned about, deeply concerned, about what is happening there on the ground. On the other hand, Moscow has been reluctant to send in peacekeeping troops, possibly because it doesn't want to get dragged into a difficult and dangerous situation where its troops could get bogged down for a long period. By sending in advisers, it can at least appear to be doing something to assist the government of Kyrgyzstan, which has asked for its aid, without actually committing large numbers of troops. The Russians, of course, may also be a bit reluctant to commit large numbers of troops because they are in a process of a reset of relations with the United States. It's not clear what the US reaction would be to Russian troops going in. And Dmitry Medvedev, the Russian president, is visiting Washington next week and may not want to make any rash moves this week ahead of that visit.
Neil, thank you very much. Back to you, Gideon.
Thank you very much, Helen. That's it for this week. All that's left is to thank Ed and Neil in the studio. Thank you to Helen as well, and to Tobias Buck in Jerusalem. Thank you all for listening. World Weekly was produced by Rob Minto. Now, I'll be in South Africa next week, but Helen will be here to guide you through world events. So until next week, goodbye.
For more downloads, go to ft.com/podcasts.